The separation of church and state has been a big part of American democracy since the country's founding, but the meaning of that idea and how to put it into practice has been controversial to the present day. Thomas Jefferson wrote about it to the Danbury Baptist Association in 1802, stating, quote, "I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state," end quote. While the U.S. government never established a state religion as many European countries did, the lines between church and state sometimes get blurry. Questions have come up lately on the issue about Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's speech on Christian leadership, which was posted on the State Department website, and Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke saying religious organizations should lose their tax-free status if they discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. Sarah Benish is an associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, we just heard that phrase, separation of church and state, and that quote from Thomas Jefferson. It's famously there. That line itself isn't in the Constitution, which a lot of people point out. Where did the importance of this idea, the separation between church and state, come from?
Well, I think it really comes from the reason that the founders came to the United States, or to what would become the United States in the first place, this idea that they wanted to get away from religious persecution. So it's really one of the main founding principles of the country. And so, you know, they were very committed to that, but that doesn't mean it's easy to define or how to or easy to draw lines around.
Right. How often does this come up in the courts over American history? What exactly the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment means?
Oh, my goodness. There's a huge set of case law that the Supreme Court has gone through, and it's incredibly confusing and difficult to completely understand. I teach a course on it at UWM, and it's a fascinating course because we really walk away from the course knowing a lot and knowing nothing. You know, given the justices' proclivities and given the different interpretations of what that separation of church and state, what that wall is supposed to look like, you know, any given court is going to decide cases in a different way than its previous courts might have. So there's just so much going on in the discussion over what is an establishment of religion and to what degree does the government have to protect free exercise.
One thing that seemed pretty clear all along was that we weren't going to have something like the Church of England, which was a religious bureaucracy that was also at the same time part of the government. Everybody kind of agreed on that one, it seems like, right, Sarah?
Right, right. That's right. Although some of the colonies had sort of state religions established. So there's it's not completely clear that everyone was on the same page with that. And in fact, some of the framers were just mostly interested in protecting their own religion, right? And not all the other minority religions that might be there. But today, I think everyone would agree that if the United States were to somehow decide to declare itself a blank nation, Christian, Muslim, whatever, that would be beyond the pale.
Talking to Sarah Benish from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the separation of church and state and issues that come up to the present day. Let's get into one that put this in the news lately, Sarah. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke to the American Association of Christian Counselors earlier this month. His speech and its posting on the State Department website in particular sparked some controversy. Here's a listen.
As believers, we draw on the wisdom of God to help us get it right, to be a force for good in the lives of human beings. Now, I know that even having just said that, I know some people in the media will break out the pitchforks when they hear that I ask God for direction in my work. But you should know. But you should know, as much as I'd like to claim originality, it is not a new idea. I love this quote from President Lincoln. He said that he said, quote, "I have been driven many times upon my knees by the overwhelming conviction I had nowhere else to go." And so with that in mind, I want to use my time today to think about what it means to be a Christian leader.
Now, there's nothing that controversial about that, is there, Sarah? A government official is saying they're a Christian and speaking in public about how that that shapes their leadership. In this case, there's nothing that really violates the establishment of church and state in and of itself there, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we expect our leaders to have religious views. And in fact, there's some surveys that political sciences have done that suggest that a person who didn't have religious views would have a very difficult time gaining national office in our country. We have a very religious history. And so, you know, that is something, you know, there's religion all over our public ceremonies. And so that's not at all unexpected.
One thing that people have objected to more, though, is that this was posted on the State Department website earlier this month. So that use of a public government forum to promote this, does that get into grayer territory?
I think a little bit. I see why people were upset and why that was jarring to a lot of different groups who felt like that was the government saying that if they were not Christian, that they don't belong, or that the State Department is somehow promoting Christian leaders over other kinds of leaders. And the State Department took it down very quickly, to its, you know, credit. And so I think, you know, we are very careful about where the line is. But like I said earlier, it's hard to draw the line. And so it's difficult to figure out when we're crossing over to a degree where we're actually talking about a violation of the Constitution.
Another thing that put this issue in the news, Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke got pushed back for comments he made at CNN's Equality Town Hall earlier this month. He made comments about religious organizations. Here's some of what he said to Don Lemon, I think, asking the questions here.
This is from your LGBTQ plan, and here's what you write. This is a quote. Freedom of religion is a fundamental right, but it should not be used to discriminate. Do you think religious institutions like colleges, churches, charities, should they lose their tax-exempt status if they oppose same-sex marriage?
Yes. There can be no reward, no benefit, no tax break for anyone or any institution, any organization in America that denies the full human rights and the full civil rights of every single one of us. And so as president, we're going to make that a priority, and we are going to stop those who are infringing upon the human rights of our fellow Americans.
And that, Sarah, has raised concern. People saying, wait a minute, this is the president using the threat of, or a would-be president, raising the threat of using a church's tax-exempt status or other organization's tax-exempt status. Some people have said to punish them for a particular political viewpoint. What do you make of that back and forth?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting, it's an interesting discussion, and it's especially interesting because his Democratic compatriots sort of backed away from him immediately upon hearing about that. So it's not a popular thing to talk about taxing churches, and that's a very clear violation of the separation of church and state as we have understood it historically, that, you know, once the state taxes an organization, then all of a sudden the state has something to say about the way the organization is run and the way they spend its money. And they have to report to the government what they're spending money on and how much money they're making. And all of those things make people very uncomfortable in terms of an excessive entanglement between the state and religion. So we have this historical assumption that churches are on their own because they're doing good work that the society values. And so, you know, we grant that tax exemption to make sure we maintain that separation. But there has been a lot of concern about what that tax exemption means to the endorsement of religion. So we give churches different treatment than we give other charitable organizations. And so some would argue that that actually preferences religion in a way that itself would violate Establishment Clause, which again is why I said these things are so complicated. But I think, you know, his immediate reaction to say, you know, yes, we're going to take that tax exemption away, he's already walked that back and really couched it as more about discrimination. And that's a completely different question that is also extremely relevant and timely right now.
Right. And that's those are things that have come up in court rulings over the Affordable Care Act and providing birth control and things, I think, like the Hobby Lobby case. Seems like the government, for the most part, has tried to be as hands off as it can with actual religious organizations, though, and letting religious organizations define what they are and just really trying not to nudge its way into those. Is that historically generally the trend?
Yes, that is true. Generally speaking, the government is not in the business of deciding which religions are real and which ones aren't, which religions are right, which ones are wrong, what sort of position a religion should take. So the idea that the government would have anything to say about whether or not a religion is in opposition to gay marriage, I think, is pretty controversial in terms of the First Amendment. A closer question, I think, is it acceptable for a church-run school, for example, to fire a teacher because he is gay? And that, I think, was what Beto ends up coming back to saying, that that was what he was arguing. even though that isn't exactly what he said at the town hall.
Talking to Sarah Benish, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. She's with us to talk about the separation of church and state and some recent political controversies and questions about that topic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the separation of church and state in the United States? How do you think it should be implemented? What questions do you have? And in the news lately, is there anything that's striking you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the concept of separation of church and state and the role it plays in American politics. It's been in the headlines from the Secretary of State to a Democratic presidential candidate and more. Sarah Benish is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of the separation of church and state? How should lawmakers and politicians utilize that concept to keep church and state separate? Do you want to hear your lawmakers, your candidates talking about religion and how it informs their views? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to a caller now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hello. I need to ask a question about nonprofits, okay? When the government gives nonprofit, let's say you're an apartment complex, but you're a nonprofit, they give them, you know, tax break. Why don't those buildings, those owners have to be energy efficient, have no smoking, hire the poor to do their lawns and the remodeling and the shoveling? Why doesn't the government have something to say about that?
I think a little off topic there, Mary Kay. We're mainly talking about religion and the government, but thanks for calling in. That's something we might check out in another conversation. So, Sarah, turning from that, I want to turn to comments now from William Barr, Attorney General, speaking at an address at the University of Notre Dame earlier this month. I'm going to quote a little bit of it. He said, "Secularists and their allies among the progressives have marshaled all the force of mass communications, popular culture, the entertainment industry, and academia in an unremitting assault on religion and traditional values." Now, here, people are a little worried about this. Again, this is a politician expressing their personal views at a public address. But people are looking at this saying, wait a minute, this is the Attorney General who will be making important legal decisions in the United States, expressing very strong viewpoints against a particular group of Americans. Does that bring us into some different territory?
I think that could get us into some different territory, sure. I think the you know, the ideas behind the separation of church and state apply equally to people who don't have religion as they do to people who do have religion. The idea is that the government shouldn't have anything to say about what you believe, and your place in the government shouldn't have anything to say about or shouldn't be driven by in any way what you believe. And so I think, you know, depending on what he means, I think this current administration is much more focused on religious discrimination, in that religious discrimination focus is much more closely placed on Christianity. And, you know, that can get into some issues of disproportionate treatment of different kinds of believers. And I think that could get into some constitutional issues.
Let's bring on a caller now. Roy is with us in Brandon. Roy, hi.
Hi. I was just listening, and a lot of times when I hear news reports about separation of church and state, I find myself a little confused, because as I was studying religion, as I was coming up as a teenager in religious classes, my understanding of the separation of church and state had to do and was based on the fact that we came out of England, where the church was state-sponsored and state-run, and basically the king was the head of the religion, even though he claimed that it was the bishops. And I always assumed that separation of church and state had to do with keeping the government out of establishment and backing religions, you know, throwing their weight behind any particular one religion, and not so much about keeping religion out of government.
Roy, thanks for the call. And it does cut both ways, right, Sarah?
Yeah, I'm sorry. My phone cut out a little bit, so I didn't hear all of Roy's question.
Okay, he was saying that his understanding. Actually, I think let's reconnect with Sarah. We'll try a different connection. We were doing great there, and it was kind of falling apart. We're talking to Sarah Benesch, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. We're looking at the separation of church and state, where it came from in the lead up to the U.S. Constitution, and issues that it faces today, gray areas, points that come up with the courts and in American politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there an issue at the national or state or even local level where you wonder how this works, how it all plays out, how it all fits into the law and the intent in the Constitution, where the line should be between religious expression and the U.S. government? We have Sarah back with us. So our caller, Roy, was saying, Sarah, he thought that, and we were talking about this a little earlier, coming out of England, the idea of the separation of church and state was meant just to make sure that the government wasn't interfering with religion. So it was meant to keep the state out of the church, not necessarily vice versa, he thought. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a fair reading. I think the founders and the people of that time were very comfortable having religious aspects in government. You know, there are so many different religious ceremonies that are official ceremonies that are, you know, started with a prayer or ended with a prayer, or, you know, there are different functionalities of, you know, for example, the Congress has a chaplain. So I think the founders in that time frame, those people were very comfortable with having religious be a part of their lives and a part of their government. But yeah, they didn't want the government to decide which religion they needed to adhere to, and they didn't want that to be something that was government sponsored.
Thanks for that call, Roy. We'll go to Karen now in Hurdle. Karen, hi.
Hi. I'm really frightened, frankly, by the erosion I see of the separation of church and state. But I'm wondering, how do we define church? You know, how do we define mega churches that are bringing in these vast amount of money? And is it really the church, or is it the lobbying arm of very extremist organizations that we're talking about when we discuss what is happening with not just being free to express religion, but free from other people's religion?
Karen, thanks for the call. Sarah, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Beto O'Rourke discussion sort of brings up that issue, and that's that, you know, some people would argue that these mega churches are not religious groups in the way that we expect them to be, in the way that the framers perhaps anticipated that they would be. And so the huge salaries that are being paid and the extravagant lifestyles are in some ways being seen as being subsidized through these tax deductions or these tax breaks or you know, the ban on property taxes religious buildings. And so I do think that that makes it more difficult to understand what the relationship ought to be. But we also have to remember that the Supreme Court has been very careful about never imposing its own definition of religion or doing any kind of test for truth or anything beyond a real belief. So if someone has a true belief and it's not scientific and it's not political and it's not something else, then it can be deemed to be a religion. And so it gets really difficult if we want to try to start drawing lines between different groups and deciding what's a religion, what isn't.
Has it been a challenge for courts and policymakers as people of different religions start to be bigger and bigger factors in the U.S. population? Catholics at one point, Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, Muslims in more recent years. Does this raise new questions about how church and state get along?
I think it makes everything a little bit more important. I think, you know, the separation of church and state becomes all the more necessary when we have all different kinds of people believing all different kinds of things, and there are no longer any sort of marginalized tiny little groups of religions. Because generally speaking, when we have an issue with religion, it's the majority imposing its will over a minority religion. And so, you know, as we get more religions, it makes the landscape, I think, a little bit more complicated. But I think that idea that Karen raised about being free from religion is important too, because again, as I said earlier, not being religious is also a group, right? And so we want our government to treat all of those groups equally and to be equally available to all of those kinds of groups. And that gets difficult when we have, you know,
lots and lots of different groups.
I've heard the argument from both sides over the years in various church and state disputes that it could be a slippery slope, that this one decision here is a step toward either further erosion of religious rights or further incursion of religion into government. Is there really a slippery slope, or is it just like lots of gray area that we're trying to sort out all the time, Sarah?
Yeah, I think there is just a ton of gray area. You know, so the court has used all different kinds of tests to decide when a given government action violates the First Amendment. And the court itself doesn't agree among the members or over time on what that test is. So the court has talked about, you know, that laws need to have a secular purpose and that they can't inhibit or promote religion. And then later the court says, well, all we need to worry about is that the government can't endorse religion. And then later the court says, well, as long as the government doesn't coerce people into religious exercise. And so I think I'm not sure about slippery slopes. I think, you know, there's ebbs and flows. And I think sometimes the Supreme Court is more protective of religion. Sometimes the Supreme Court is less protective of religious groups, more protective of those not espousing a religion. And, you know, probably nobody's ever happy with the balance that we're striking.
It's a good place to leave it with all of us unhappy. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime. I'm happy to come and, you know, rain on your parade.
That's Sarah Benesch, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. She joins us today to talk about the role of the separation of church and state in national politics and our understanding of democracy and some recent public comments by elected officials and candidates that have raised new issues.